Hello, this is Bill Knauer, and you're listening to Author, where we talk about writing and life. That's right, because what it takes to write the book you want to write is also what it takes to lead the life you want to lead. That's true. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. You can learn all about it at authormagazine.org. And we are funded by the good people at the Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. We're going to have a conference in September, and I hope it's going to be live and in person and at a brand new location. Oh, it's beautiful. Anyway, good people there. We have good meetings. You can attend them from wherever you are virtually. Come join up. Go over to pnwa.org and learn all about it. Yeah. Well, listen. Oh, it's good to be talking to you all. I got a great guest today. You're going to love him, Bernard McLaverty, Irish author. Oh, what an interesting guy. He writes novels and short stories, but also screenplays, librettos for opera. Yes, and just had a lot to say about stories and writing and creativity. He has a new short story collection out called Blank Pages. And he is the author of five previous collections of short stories and five novels, including Grace Notes, which was shortlisted for the Booker Prize, and Midwinter Break, shortlisted for the International Dublin Literary Award. And, well, anyway, great guy, great conversation, and I'm so glad I get to share it with you. Enjoy. Okay, Bernard, welcome. Welcome to the show.
Hi there, Bill.
Well, Bernard, listen, congratulations first on book number, I don't know what. Do you know? Do you have the number?
If we count them in short stories, then this is book six, I think.
Collection of short stories, but you're a novelist too, of course.
There's five of those to be read.
Yeah. So, all right. So here you are. You're a bunch of books in. You've accomplished a lot. You've produced a lot. When did this really start? Ask you this. Do you remember your earliest recollection of caring about stories? Like, I'm interested in stories. Like, these are cool.
Yeah, absolutely. And it came out of school, I think, how a good teacher can fire you up in some way, you know, and maybe you have an input into that as well. Sure. When he comes and deals 30 copies of fact and fiction onto your desk, and you start reading it, and suddenly, and I can remember the story that kind of wakened me up was the occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge by Ambrose Bierce.
Yes, yes. Wow. Okay.
I said, wow, this is great. This is wonderful. And it's a story. It's a story with a trick ending in a way, which I have kind of avoided, I think, since that. But the kind of atmosphere, the trickery, the tension, all of that was there on that kind of first reading. Then in the same book, there would have been other more local writers, a namesake of mine called Michael McLaverty, who wrote beautiful short stories, one called The Potsheen Maker. Potsheen, said he, drinking from a glass of a clear liquid, which is potsheen.
Okay, I did not know. Is that a Gaelic word?
It is, yes, and it's for alcohol, and it's a whiskey made from potatoes or sugar.
Right.
And this was a beautiful story about a teacher who was a. You don't know this until the story, but you know he's a you learn he's an alcoholic, and he conducts a lesson which is evaporation and condensation, and he puts brown sugar and stuff into, and he makes it, and he said it's the clearest of the clear water. And he, just to prove that it's clear water, he drinks it in front of the class. And the door opens and an inspector walks in.
Matt, look at you, can still remember that story. Look how that is burned it. Now, I remember talking to Frank Delaney. Do you ever know Frank?
Yes, I did. I did.
I love Frank.
No longer with us.
No, he isn't. God rest his soul. But he and I met through these interviews and kind of became a little bit of pals. And I was a huge Joyce fan, and I was also a fan of just the oral tradition of storytelling. Like, I grew up telling people stories, and he was like, oh, yes, yes, of course, in Ireland, this is such a thing. Was that the case for you, or was it really like, no, it's reading, and my family didn't tell stories?
No. It was kind of like talk, you know, rather than stories. Than stories, because talk is stories. You know, that if you go to a funeral and somebody says, you'll never know who was there. Do you know?
Right, that's the story.
Frank Delaney was there. What? Oh,
right. That's right.
So that's a story. My family were full of those kind of things. So, and I grew up in a house that had my mother and father and my brother. And then after the war, my grandfather and my grandmother and my great aunt came to live with us.
Oh my God, that's a book in the making right there.
And they talked they talked all the time, and I have lovely memories of them, and fights and scraps. They appear in some stories that I've written about my great aunt Mary, that kind of tradition was there. There was a bookcase in the house, a glass-fronted bookcase, which you pulled down a desktop and it'd give a big squeak.
You know what? We had one of those. We had one of those too. And that was right in the hall, and you pull it down. Wasn't the same one, I'm sure. And there were all these old books were in there stored.
Yes, yes. And they were mostly holy books. Saintly books, you know, but there were some novels and short stories, but they were all good, clean material. And later, my mother was to say to me, when she learned that I was writing, she said, "You know, son, I just pray every night that you'll not write anything dirty."
I assume you were a regularly attending Catholic family. Is that?
That's correct. Correct.
Yeah.
There would have been mass in the mornings when the ice was on the ground. And I was an altar boy. But you see, the thing, I don't believe a word of it now, but the thing that's important is that at that age, you were introduced to things like imagery. That you went and you served a mass, and the priest was wearing red or black or green vestments, and this was symbolic of sort of joy or sorrow or tragedy death, and so you know the language. The Latin, the mysteriousness, like it was like witches around,
right?
Around the
also,
cauldron.
It does direct your attention. I was raised; my parents were met in the church. My father attended Harvard Divinity, but by the time I came along, there was none of that. So there was a real agnosticism towards religion, meaning they weren't going to speak for or against it. So I was really up to me. But I do feel like there is something about religion if you're raised in it. It does point your attention towards something greater than yourself. And I think of James Lee Burke as a suspense writer. I interviewed a wonderful suspense writer. He said, look, man,
you better make peace with whatever God you pray to. Because if you think you're doing these stories on your own, you're nuts. You can't do it on your own. Whatever you call it, whatever you call it, there's something that you work with, whether you call it the muse or God or whatever, that you're working with when you're writing. Now, does that resonate with you?
I don't know. I don't think so. Okay. I mean, but then if I turn around and sort of beat my chest and say, I'm doing it on my own,
right, you know, right.
but there's nobody else out there. But the people that help were the friends that I had, the people who had conversations, people's own creativity comes into me. And I try and organize it the best I can.
Yeah.
I sit down and hope for it to come through the pen or the computer or whatever.
You hope for it. You hope for it. Now, it's come through a lot for you. It's come through a lot. This is one of the great mysteries of writing. Like, you've written a lot of stuff, right? You've been at this a while.
Yes.
Every time you sit down, I remember Alice Hoffman said to me, wonderful American novelist, and she's written a lot of books. And she said, every time she starts one, she thinks, I don't know how to do this. Like, because it's a new book, right?
Yeah,
like, how do I write a novel again? How do I do this? Does that resonate?
I'm very, very conscious of that. You know, that you sit down and you say, how do I do this? Because you could have just finished a wonderful story.
Right. Right.
And you've worked at it for 3 months or something.
Right.
And then you say, now I'm going to write a story about the opposite of that, but I don't know how to do it. What you have just done is of no use whatsoever.
That's right. No
what
help.
You're going to do.
Right.
So the blank page confronts you.
Yeah.
And I thought that there's a story in the new collection called Blank Pages.
Right.
And I thought that was a good kind of a title that would frighten the life out of a writer. And that you're confronted by the blank page. And in this particular story, the blank pages are used for other than writing on.
Right. Right.
The man is an author, and he uses, well, he has no real use for the paper or the A4 sheets or the foolscap sheets that he has in his study. So he uses them for something else. I don't want to give it away.
Oh, no, don't give it away. Don't give it away. It's a good story. And have you written much? I've been on a run of talking to writers who, I write about the creative process. Like, that is what I write about. Creativity, writing, generally speaking, in the broadest sense. And recently, the novelists I've interviewed, a couple American novelists, have written about writers. Jason Mott, who won the National Book Award, was then a debut novelist. Some writers like to write about writers. Some will never do it. It seems like everyone's drawn to it. How often, I'm not intimately familiar with your work, how often have you had a protagonist who is an author? Besides
not much. A couple in short stories, but I do tend to write about living and about life and about families and but also about art in a way. That in some way I've said to you that I kind of have no great belief in God at the moment.
Okay, you're good.
The substitute for that is art in a way, that we observe each other, that we hope for the best for each other. And there are some people who don't do that. There are some people who do the opposite to that. But religion has, in my mind, been substituted by art, which is music or drawing, writing a song, writing poems. It's all about how we observe other people. I've written about painters, I've written a novel about a composer, a girl, called Grace Notes. And it's a kind of conflict. The conflict that exists in it is that she is creative, she wants to be a composer, but she gets pregnant. And now she produces a baby, she produces a symphony. And these two things are directly opposite. So that took a great deal of effort, I think, in trying to put myself in the position of somebody who's having a baby.
Yes.
But I talked long and hard with my wife about this, and she supplied information and insights that were wonderful, and the things that I hadn't thought about. And so I then supplied the interest in music. I have, since I was a teenager, I started, I had these friends that I talked about, that one of them would, we'd walk home from school and he'd say, do you fancy coming in and I'm playing some opera? And he,
opera?
He
would,
Yeah.
Wow. And At that age, okay.
He had a small dance set. Well, I mean, now we would have been maybe 15, 16.
Still, now, please. When I was 15 or 16, I did not know a soul who admitted to listening to opera. So I'm impressed.
So we would go here in and he would play Caruso and Gallicurci and right. Maria Callas and
Callas,
and we got to know a whole lot of stuff, and eventually an opportunity came around to me from Scottish Opera, who said, "Would you like to write some lyrics for an opera with a composer, an Irishman called Gareth Williams, who sounds like a Welshman?" But, he and I put our minds together and we wrote a very short opera. It's like the short story, only opera.
I didn't know they had such things. I thought they had to be 3 hours or they weren't going to bother.
No. This happened there were the evening's entertainment was called 5:15.
I see. There were
5 15-minute operas. And so you got to really work hard to bring it down to 15 minutes.
Yeah. You got to have a story. So were you you supplied the lyrics, but did you supply the narrative also, or did you guys collaborate?
It was like a short story, only singing it.
Hey, that must have been fun. That must have been a lot of fun.
So I have done for Scottish Opera now about five of these.
Wow.
And I operatized. I've just operatized.
Hey, but listen, I know you've done screenplays too. They made Lamb into a movie. It was Lamb, right? So you've got to see your work, you know, cinematized, which is still, they have to change it. They've got to change it. But it seems to me the nice thing about the opera as a novelist and short story writer, where it's like, okay, I write the thing and then God knows what happens to it. You know, then it goes into the imagination. You get to actually see it. You get to see someone, you know, the first time, I quickly share this with you, when I was in my 20s and I had started writing a play, but I was an actor too. So I was imagining all the lines in my own head just because that's what I would do. And then I gave it to my friend who was an actor. I said, let's do the scene together. And he started reading it. And it was the first time I'd heard someone take something I'd written and reinterpret it. And it come out. And it was magical to me hearing it come through another voice. Did any of that happen to you as you were listening to these singers translate your language into song in that way?
But not necessarily. Well, that was in the case of the opera. But my first instance of what you're talking about was that I had written a long short story called My Dear Palestrina.
Okay.
And it was about a music teacher and a boy. I submitted it to the BBC for radio. They accepted it. And I also submitted it, unbeknownst to them, I think, as for television. So we had two versions of the same thing.
Wow.
And the second one, the television one, was the actress Eleanor Braun. She was a wonderful actress, and she could play the piano. And so that suddenly here was a character who I had concocted in my head.
Yeah.
And somebody else totally believed in this character. It was a kind of staggering event to see somebody else. I mean, she came in to the rehearsal and sat down at the piano with the boy actor and started playing Haydn. And I didn't even know she could play. And then she takes a comb out of her pocket and puts her hair up while the boy is trying to play. You know, and these people are real. And suddenly you realize that you've created them.
Yeah.
You've made them, and they're better than you thought. Yeah. So
it's great. So
and in each case, the Lamb, the novel with Liam Neeson was a wonderful actor who did the business, and it's a sad and awful situation that he's in. Another was Cal with Helen Mirren and actress like that. Wonderful.
How great to get Helen Mirren. She just seems to have gotten better and better and better and better as she goes along. Wow.
Absolutely. And, you know, to see these things being come back to you and to do well. I mean, at the Cannes Film Festival, she got Best Actress.
Oh, nice. All thanks to you, clearly. And your fantastic script.
Yeah, but these are things that you accept as you go along. You start off and nobody knows a word that you've written. And,
right.
And these are like very small wavelets coming in.
Yeah.
And you say, okay, well, there's somebody, my mother knows that I
write. See, and, hey, listen, wait. Listeners, did you hear that? Listen, eventually Helen Mirren speaking his lines, but first, just like all of you, it starts with his mom, right?
Yeah.
His ma, let's do it. We're all starting the same place, don't we?
Yeah. So this is each increment or step as you go on. The last novel now, I was writing a screenplay for it for Midwinter Break. Now, and then what comes along but COVID, and nobody's doing any work. And, we'll have to wait till the conditions improve. A company have said that they want to do it.
Good. Hey, wait. I was wondering, I live in the US, and I am part of the writing community here. The writing, and it's pretty robust. There's lots of writing conferences and workshops being taught, and there's an MFA program at every college. There's writing groups, people forming writing groups. There's just a lot of people writing and thinking about writing and wanting to write in the US. What's it like over there in the UK? Is it a pretty robust community, or is it smaller and more insular?
I think it's good. I mean, but the COVID thing has been very bad.
It's broken us up a little.
That it seems to be that the emphasis has now gone into television. That television is easier to make than movies.
I wonder why.
I don't know, but I suppose, you know, 10 episodes of something.
Right.
The way it used to be one episode, and you call it a television play.
Right. Yeah, it's the same in the US. Now it's 6 to 10 episodes, the miniseries, essentially.
Yes. And so the company and the money people are in control of the whole thing.
Right.
Can make it and can, you know, make the rules that people don't end up with COVID or whatever. I have then swung around and said, okay, I'll concentrate on the written word on the page. And in the last couple of, 5-10 years, I have written a novel and a book of short stories. I am not prolific.
No.
But I do.
But what do you attribute that?
I can put it on my passport that I'm a writer.
Well, sure, yeah. But do you write? Do you don't write on a schedule? Then you write more like what, or maybe you do like. So, what is your sort of routine? Do you have one?
No, not really. When I want to write a story, I generally settle down and write it. And okay. But when you're walking along the street, you're writing.
Yeah. It never really stops, does it?
No. That's right.
Yeah.
You're doing it all the time. And then when you do sit down to write, it kind of feeds through somehow or other. I don't know how it happens, but it's like I recently thought of an image for it. Like it's like breastfeeding. It's
the first time I've heard it that way. Okay, fill me in.
Well, because the act of sitting down and writing means that the image is that the breast, when the baby feeds on it, it produces the milk.
Right. Right. It is the, it's right. The cry of the baby will cause the mother to lactate.
Yes.
That's right.
So when you're sitting down, to write and you haven't a notion what you're going to get, you start an image or something. Of
then the juices.
And then the act of sucking is equivalent to the act of writing.
That's right. There is something Pavlovian about, I write right here, like 6:15 every morning. And there's something that I always tell my students, there's a little difference between your domestic frame of mind where you're interacting with things and the writing frame of mind where you have to stop interacting and go in and receive the story or whatever you're writing about. And there's something for me that kicks in when I'm here at this time. I sort of trained myself, now it's time to do it. And it's easy for me to drop into that. That's my personal thing.
Yeah.
Similar to what you're talking about, I think.
I mean, one of the things about art that I was talking about was a story called At the Beach. Mm-hmm. And it was like, no, it wasn't. that's a different story.
Too many stories.
Yes. The idea of a blind painter. What could be worse than a writer without a story or without the ability to write? And then I say, what could be worse than that? And it's the thought that you could be a blind painter. This man wants to continue painting,
right.
And he hires somebody to put the paint on for him. It's a kind of irony. He's an Irishman who's gay, who had to go away to Portugal to work, and he brings his lover with him, and he puts on the canvas, and he tells him what color it is, very precisely what color it is. Like it's a color of
but he never gets to see if he likes his work. He never gets to hey, you know who I think of when you tell me that story? Beethoven, baby. Old Ludwig von, he was nearly stone deaf when he wrote Ode to Joy.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, it's a mirror. It's one of my favorite stories. The Ninth, one of the greatest symphonies ever, was written by a guy who, like the one guy who never heard the Ode to Joy was the guy who wrote it. Except right?
Yes.
Oh, these are good stories. Bernard, you're a very interesting guy. I am glad we are connected through the magic of the internet across the globe. So the new book is called Blank Pages. And if you like good short stories, and I do, you will like this. They're written with heart and intelligence and, of course, loads of craft. But I'm not done with you yet, Bernard. I have one more question for you. And what I would like you to do is finish this sentence. If writing, all the writing you've done, the librettos, the short stories, the novels, if it's taught you anything, it's taught you what?
It's taught me... not to give glib answers to questions like that.
Good. Good.
it's taught me that seeing the world and analyzing it and recreating it is kind of a joy. It's dark, it's black. When you come from somewhere like Northern Ireland, sure, where they have shot each other and they hate each other, yeah, and murders and injuries and bombs, and you know, yeah, those kind of things, you have got to be written about. And you don't write about them and sort of jump and click your heels and whistle into the sunset.
No.
But there is also a joy in the way that we live our lives and read other people's work and the joy of the mind and the short story. The short story is wonderful because you can sit down in a chair and in a couple of hours you can rearrange your mental furniture for the rest of your life.
Ah, the joy. Yeah. Well, we were just talking about Ode to Joy, and I got to say, if that's going to teach you the joy of being alive a little bit, I'm okay with that. Bernard, thank you. You're a very interesting guy. This was a lot of fun.
Okay, I enjoyed it too.
Thank you. Told you he was fun, isn't he? Yeah, you got to believe me when I tell you these things. Joy, people. It's all about the joy. Love and joy, it's all the same thing. Well, this has been a lot of fun. I'm going to be back again next week. I think I'm going to be live, because I do like being live. But until then, go find something you love. Go find something that brings you some joy. And just do it.